just now. So just three in English and everybody else, four or five. Okay, great, thank you. Can I just say thank you so much for bearing with me in that. And I do apologize that my French is just not good enough to even begin to think about doing this in French. So thank you for bearing with me. And also a big thank you for turning out on a Saturday morning to yet another Zoom meeting. And I know that you have more than enough. I have more than enough. And so we'll aim to stick to our time, and I'll aim to make this as interesting as possible. And we'll break about halfway through for some discussion, some conversation about some of the points that I'm going to be raising. Okay, well, our topic is engaging in our professional spheres as academics, postgrads, with a Christian mindset. And for me personally, this question was brought into sharp focus when I first went into psychiatry as a young doctor back in the ancient history, the mid-1970s. And at that time, psychiatry itself was undergoing a period of rapid change. The old medical model, which had presided over thousands of large institutions across Europe, was being seriously challenged, the anti-psychiatry movement. The grip of psychoanalysis on the therapeutic professions was being weakened. We were witnessing the rise of the human potential movement, new therapies, gestalt therapy, transactional analysis. And these new therapies were rising and being invented, very often rooted in humanistic or Eastern worldviews, or alternatively shifting the focus of our understanding in mental health from the individual to society. And as a Christian believer, how did I begin to make sense of what was going on? Could I with integrity practice in such a world? Where were the boundaries for me as a Christian? What might be the opportunities? Well, luckily for me, around the same time, the concept of worldview came to prominence in evangelical thinking. Around the 60s, 70s, people such as Francis Schaeffer giving evangelical Christians who had been schooled in piety the beginnings of a confidence in engaging intellectually with the world around them. And evangelical Christians gradually became more confident, not only in defending their own worldview, but in the realization that all operate within frameworks of assumptions about how the world works. We became more confident in a Christian apologetics that exposes and explores the assumptions of others as well as our own, the normative postulates, the cognitive biases behind the worldviews of other people as well as our own. And once I'd realized this, I was able to engage with my professional sphere with much greater confidence. It leveled the playing field. It led to a much more fruitful debate. And so if we want to be confident as Christians, biblical Christians working in the humanities, we have to grow our skills in worldview analysis and, of course, self-reflection. But I don't actually want that to be the main topic of our session together today. I want to approach our topic, how to engage our professional spheres with a Christian mindset, from a different angle. Instead of talking about our worldview, I want to talk about a term, a concept used by the Danish philosopher Kierkegaard. I want to talk about your life view. And what did Kierkegaard mean by that? The importance of Christians having a life view. Well, it's not super complex. The approach of worldview analysis keeps the question of how we engage our professional spheres with a Christian mindset at the level of ideas, at the level of the intellect. The idea of a life view, in contrast, explores this question at the level of the heart, at the level of my motivations, exploring my desires, my emotions. Or to put it another way, rather than exploring the relationship between my academic work and my view of the world, a life view pushes us into the relationship between my academic work and my view of myself, what it means to be me, how my understanding of myself shapes the way I talk. And I'm going to talk for about 20 minutes, then we'll stop. And then I want to finish by asking some very practical questions. I just see that my internet connection became unstable for a moment. So let me just take off my VPN just for one moment. There we go.
You may just give us again the definition of a live view, because this was the bit we didn't get, and I think it's a good one.
Okay, thank you. I'll just go back to that. The approach of worldview analysis keeps the question of how we engage our professional spheres with a Christian mindset. That's our question. It explores that question at the level of ideas. The concept of a life view, in contrast, explores this question at the level of the heart, exploring motivation, desires, the sphere of our emotions, our concepts of self, of identity. Or to put it another way, rather than exploring the relationship between my academic world and my view of the world, the worldview, it pushes into the relationship between my academic work and my view of myself, what it means to be me, how my understanding of myself shapes the way I approach my work. And it's from that perspective that I want to pursue the remainder of this talk. And I'm going to explore this question under three headings. First, how does a Christian mindset affect the way I think about my identity as an academic? Second, how does it affect the way I think about my value and worth as an academic? Third, how does it affect the way I think about my calling as an academic? Okay, and then, as I say, we'll focus on some very practical challenge in the final few minutes about this very practical one of how do we think about our achievements as academics and our failures, and especially the relationship between achievement and our sense of worth. And we'll unpack that in a more practical way toward the end. Okay, so our three questions. Let's start by thinking about how a Christian mindset affects the way I think about my identity. Well, of course, we could spend several talks on exploring the concept of personal identity. But obviously, I'm going to give you a working definition that will guide my own thinking about this and our conversation later. It's a complex area, but here's the definition I'm working with. A personal identity is the story we tell ourselves about ourselves. Human beings are questioning creatures. We come into the world primed to ask questions about it. What? Why? What's going on here? What's the story? And uniquely among living creatures, we human beings not only evaluate the world, but we evaluate ourselves. What am I? Who am I? What's my story? And quite simply, identity is the answer we give to that question. It is the story we tell ourselves about ourselves, fulfilling that notion of such as Alistair MacIntyre and Charles Taylor, the philosopher, that we are fundamentally narrative animals, as Alistair MacIntyre, the moral philosopher, put it. Of course, if you think about the story of your life so far, there are many different parts to it. And much of this sense of personal story is under the bonnet. It is pre-conscious or unconscious and has to be teased out. But if you think at a superficial level about the different parts of your story so far, there's your age and sex and social status. There's your education. There's your sexuality. There's your relationship commitments. There's the sphere of your passions and interests and ambitions. And crucially, this huge area, this sphere of work. Now, a personal identity takes all of these different parts and says, but here are the headlines. Our personal identity is the hub that holds all the spokes in place, the plot that holds the story together, the plot line of the story. And of course, for many of our colleagues and in our own hearts, our work becomes very quickly and very easily the hub, the main plot line of the story of our lives and our sense of self. And that raises an important question for the Christian, because in Christian belief, our identity, that is our sense of who we are, is not discovered by looking within the self. It is not invented by the self. For the Christian, identity is narrated on the basis of what is revealed to the self. And so the Christian view of the self challenges our tendency of our lived experience to base our sense of identity around our work. Specifically, the Christian story of the self is grounded or framed by the revealed doctrine that we human beings are made in the image of God. And despite the effects of the fall, as Christians in Christ, we are being restored in the image of God. And it's this overarching truth. It is this overarching truth which must sit at the core of our being in the world and that gives shape and meaning to everything else. So that's the first point. And it's a very simple point, and it's one we all know, but it's one we need to ponder on once again this morning, that the plot line of our personal story is to be retold, re-narrated in view of the larger story that God reveals to us and of which we're a part. Well, that then brings us to our second question. Well, how does my faith affect how I think about my sense of worth and value? Well, I suggest to you, it means your sense of basic worth and value is unconditional or non-contingent. That is, it does not depend on external recognition other than the recognition of God. The Christian doctrine of being made in the image of God, therefore recognized by God and being given worth by God, of course, is the belief that confers the same rights to life and freedom and dignity on a newly born, brain-damaged 26-year-old child, baby, lying in your hands. It is this doctrine that confirms the same rights to life and freedom and dignity on that 26-year-old fighting for its life, brain-damaged little child, as it does on the President of the French Republic or the Queen of England. This is the doctrine which drove the earliest Christian believers to ban the practice of expositio, exposing unwanted children, and especially little girls. It's a doctrine which for centuries has conferred rights to dignity, freedom, and to be treated as a person of worth. And of course, it's the doctrine that provided the basis of the Western concept of human rights and dignity. And if we come back to this, to our sense of life view, our sense of ourselves as academics, this is the person we are. This is the worth we carry in our inmost self. It is not invented or constructed or discovered within the self, simply within the confines of the self. It is given, it is revealed to the self in the will and purpose of God. Now, I want you to think a little more about this for a few moments in relation to your own life view, because whatever our professional sphere, academics, practitioners, or students, we are exposed to powerful imperatives to ground our sense of worth, our sense of self, in our achievements. I don't know whether it's the same in France. Hopefully you'll tell me in a few minutes, but academics in the UK face demanding performance management. And when I was fully employed as an academic, every 3 years, we had to have a detailed performance management inquiry. And we had to fill out various forms. And one of those forms was headed prestige indicators. Prestige indicators. And on that form, I had to list all of the appointments and the awards and the recognitions that indicated my prestige relatively within the sphere of academia. And that gave me points, and points gave my department money. And of course, this was not only an obligation, but this request to present my achievements and the prestige that was offered to my prestige achievements socially, that request, of course, feeds into a deeply rooted psychological desire for social recognition. We desire social recognition because when they give us worth, we can then give it to ourselves. And there's plenty of experimental evidence, psychological experimental evidence, to underpin that suggestion. And of course, social theorists such as Francis Fukuyama interpret and seek to understand social developments, such as today's identity politics, as born out of this profound struggle for recognition that sits at the core of our identity. And so you'll know Francis Fukuyama's book, Identity, Contemporary Identity Politics and the Struggle for Recognition. And he interprets the phenomenon, the social phenomenon, the rise of identity politics, as being driven by the inner desire for human recognition. Now, the Christian doctrine that our worth is grounded in the recognition of God challenges this dynamic. It says that no matter our achievements, whether we win or whether we lose, whether we're successful or whether we fail, we are known and loved and blessed as the very image of God. And with this at the core of our life view, we are then dispatched into the world to engage, to contribute, to be creative and inventive, like the one whose image we bear. But our achievements are not the basis of our self-worth and our identity. Our achievements are the expression of God's recognition of us and the worth accorded to us as those who bear the image of God, and for Christians, the image under restoration in the very image of Christ, his own Son. So that's the second point, the non-contingent basis of our worth. So we've arrived now at the third question we set ourselves, which is, well, what does a Christian mindset say about my sense of calling as an academic? As God's image bearers, we understand that we are people of worth with rights and worth, yes. But there are two sides to this coin of bearing the image of God. And on the other side of this coin is the reality, is that this reality of being made in the image of God not only confers upon us rights, it imposes responsibilities. It confers privileges, human rights, but also duties. And in the modern world, certainly, there's an asymmetry in our understanding of what it means to be in the image of God. We like the rights. We talk a lot about the rights and the worth that's given us as those who bear the image of God. We forget about the duties, the calling, the responsibilities that are integral to that truth. You remember the very first chapter of Genesis in which this doctrine is set out, Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, 27. What does God say there? Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female. The point here is that we're not made simply to look like God. We have been designed to be like God, endowed with agency that allows us to act like God. And in fact, the weight of scholarly opinion, and I'm not a theologian, but as far as I can discern, now points to the idea of image as being essentially bodily in nature. The Hebrew word selam for image, for instance, basically means within the context of the time, a physical carved or hewn statue or copy of a non-physical being. And Pharaoh, for example, was said to be in the image of one of the great gods, Isis. I think it was Isis. And so he was the representative of Isis on the face of the earth, doing on the earth what Isis would do if she were here. And so Yahweh's image bearers act on his behalf, in his image, like him, but carrying out the mission entrusted to them. Now, there are two things to notice about this responsibility, this duty, by the way. It has limitations and it has possibilities. So let's start with the limitations. To be made in the image of God implies that there is a givenness to the human condition. The nature of our design sets creaturely limits upon who we are. And this pushes back at our contemporary obsession with the limitless self, the self without limits, the seductions of self-identification, self-definition, the autonomous self. You remember the word autonomy means to give the self, auto, a law. I make the laws, the autonomous self. And of course, we are immersed in a culture, particularly in the UK, because we inherit it from the States, an obsession with self-definition. And I would argue that this limitation, I'd argue that this is not a blessing. It can be a curse. And that the limitation, although we have to explore and wisdom is needed in working out where the boundaries of and what precisely it means to be limited as someone who bears the image of God, this limitation is not something that is oppressive to us. It is a blessing, because we don't need to wake up every morning with a blank piece of paper asking the questions, who am I today? We are not consigned to an endless mission of self-making, a treadmill which has no grounding or frame of reference. And so to be made in the image of God suggests that we flourish when we live in harmony with our design and in submission to the limits God has placed on us as creatures called to live in his image, in his likeness, carrying out his calling. And that brings us, of course, this sense of calling has imposed limitation, but it also brings with it possibilities and purpose. To be the image of God is a mandate. And notice the syntax in verse 26 there in Genesis 1. Let us make mankind in our image so that they may rule. We make mankind in our image so that they may rule. They're given freedom in how they bear the image of God, how they creatively, uniquely express that image, to rule the earth as the physical bearers of the very nature of God. So let's think for a moment how this could affect your life view. It challenges us, I think, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. It challenges us to see our academic endeavor as a responsibility, a duty. I think we often think about it, and I did for many years, I think of it as something for which I sought God's blessing. It was something that I felt I wanted to do, and then I discovered the doctrine of being made in the image of God and the cultural mandate that I've just been talking about. And I thought, yes, this blesses what I'm doing. But I actually think it goes further than that. It mandates it requires what I'm doing to be fully human, to bear the image of God. I am called to be curious, inventive, organizing, and understanding of his world so that I may rule over it in the way that he rules. And of course, because it is in his likeness, because it's in the way that he rules, it also carries the duty to have a special heart for fairness and justice. And to have a special heart and to be especially vigilant to those who are left out, to the poor and the oppressed, because God is like that. It imposes a responsibility to carry out our calling as the image of God with kindness, fairness, and integrity. So I'd invite you to open your hearts to this sense of divine calling and to sense God's not only the obligation he places on us to be curious, but also the blessing and the pleasure he takes in our carrying out the academic duties as we bear his image in the world. And I just wonder whether you have that sense of calling in your work. That there's a strand of evangelicalism in the UK which has a very thin theology of work. In fact, I hear some suggest that work is simply blessed as having the potential to earn money to support gospel work. And that thinking is quite prevalent in some parts of very influential English evangelicalism. And going into work has very little biblical endorsement, other than as creating an opportunity for personal evangelism. Now, of course, that's important, but with respect, I'd argue that this focus on what our salvation is as glorious as that is, it neglects what our salvation is for. And as academics, we give visibility to the second of those things. Our salvation is the gospel that Jesus died for us and our claiming of that forgiveness. Our salvation is for the restoration of God's image in us, and our work is therefore an expression of our sense of duty and calling to be like the one in whose image we are made. So I think what I'm going to do there is just pause for a moment to invite any comments, disagreements. I mean, this is an area of wisdom that we're seeking to share wisdom together, to unpack. Any questions, any thoughts that you have? Now, I don't know how this might work, David, in relation to our interpretation and so on, but maybe you could guide me.
Just a moment. I got a message saying votre micro est coupé.
Non, mais ça, c'est ancien. Donc,
Okay. It wasn't. Okay. That's okay. Ça allait sur le téléphone?
Parfait.
Okay. I think I have to... Lydia, tu peux...
Voilà.
Je pense que toi, tu peux traduire en anglais les questions qui sont posées, je pense. Hein. Sinon, ça va être difficile pour moi de faire les deux.
Parce que, oui, d'accord. Donc, effectivement, on ne veut pas parler de la façon dont...
j'y pense maintenant, oui.
Voilà, parce que lui, il n'entend pas ce que tu lui dis. Ouais. Ouais.
OK. Donc, je vais rester sur le téléphone. OK.
Obviously, somebody who wants to talk in English, that's possible. And then David can translate into French on the phone. Mais si vous préférez poser vos questions et faire vos commentaires en français, soit je vais essayer de traduire, soit David va traduire, on verra ça. Nous sommes en direct là. Hein, donc, voilà. Donc, thanks, Glyn, for this very interesting introduction to the topic and the kind of setting setting the scene. So over to our participants for any comments or questions. Donc, aux participants maintenant de réagir ou de poser des questions selon ce que vous voulez. Perhaps I can ask a question. So I'm quite used to the idea that the professional work, be it in academics or in other fields, is an expression of the cultural mandate. But you seem to suggest that it's more than this, that there is a connection to the salvation in Christ. So could you flesh out this a little bit more?
Well, in the sense that the cultural mandate, I think, although I'd welcome your views, Lydia, the cultural mandate that is integral to our being made in the image of God, we find it difficult to carry out in the image of God, that is, like him, with the qualities of his character, because of sin and the fall. And therefore, our efforts to rule the world as God's rule are spoiled, perverted, and of course, exploited in our own interests rather than the interests of good rule. And therefore, as Christians, in that God restores his image in us, I suggest that he restores to us the calling, the full breadth of the calling of the cultural mandate, which is to be the image of God and therefore to rule in his place, as it were. He entrusts the world to us to steward. So we rule as the image of God, but to actually do so in the image of God, that is in his likeness with the qualities of his character. And so therefore we bring to that rule imperatives of integrity, fairness, and a special heart for the poor and the oppressed. And so I'd see in the restoration of the image of God a rebuilding, a reintegration of both the mandate to work, but also the character of God insofar as we're to reflect that as those made in his image, of moral qualities of integrity and fairness and so on. Do you want to come back, Lydia, help me a bit more with that?
So that would be about the attitude, say the virtue of the practitioner.
Yes. Yeah. And I know there's a lot of debate about in what sense we're made in the image of God. And Augustine saw it as it being about our rationality, you know, whereas others talk about the qualities, the character qualities of God, what we would call virtues. I think it's very difficult to see oneself as bearing the image of God and not to see oneself as called to live out that calling with the kindness and the virtues that he calls us into. The two are integrated. What do you think yourself?
I would like to learn from your wisdom. So perhaps to push you a little bit further, would you have an example from your own experience where you would say it's changed your way of doing your work?
Well, I think just go back and say a little more about my struggle to see my academic work. You see, my academic work is both driven by my own interests, but also the requirements of my social context, that I earn money to my kids, and particularly by an inner desire for recognition. And I see that in myself. And I think particularly the desire for social recognition and status is a very powerful motivating factor in human relationships and human activity. And so the journey of challenging that and putting it to one side, but instead relocating my desire to be a good academic within this sense of calling, I think is a lifelong calling. You know, it's a work of the imagination that one must do this. But I think as I've gone through my career, the notion of my academic work not simply being blessed by God, but being required by him, being a responsibility, if I have these gifts, to therefore carry them out as one who bears the image of God. I found that very helpful, particularly as I seek to get motivated and get going. You know, and we all struggle with this. You look at a spreadsheet, or you look at some work, or you have another grant application to write, or you have a load of things to review and papers to mark, and you think, you know, but I find it personally very helpful to think, but God, it is my duty, my calling is, this has such value in God's eyes because it's part of the mandate to bring order to his world and to bless others in their cultural, in their endeavor to understand God's world. So.
Bon, moi, j'aurais bien envie de continuer à discuter avec Lynn, mais ce n'est pas le propos de notre réunion. Donc, je vais arrêter de continuer à dialoguer et de donner l'occasion à d'autres d'intervenir.
Was that just saying, is there anybody else?
Yes, I just said that I would love to go on talking to you, but that's not the... That's not the goal or the setup for this meeting. So.
Hello, my name is Alexander. Sorry, I was a little bit late. I'm finding this subject really interesting, and I'm working in a consulting firm where identity and recognition are really strong words. And I found myself a little bit struggling between identifying with what is a Christian view and a Christian way of engaging in my work life versus this career ambition culture that everyone is promoting, because it seems like it's a bit difficult to be engaged and committed in work, and at the same time have distance to see that the career ambition is not necessarily God's will or God's recognition of you. Does it make sense?
Yeah.
And so my question is really, if we can find a recognition in being a child of God, what are the tips to really try to differentiate commitment and really career ambition?
Yes, and of course, I think there's something very godly about being ambitious to fulfill God's call and the cultural mandate. So a sense of desire to achieve certain goals can be very blessed by God. I think it is a matter of attitude. It's a matter of how we look at this. And certainly parts of my career, I got very caught up in performance management. I was running a big department in psychiatry. There were about 60 of us. I was really driven, very keen to get ourselves to be one of the top four in the country. And we had a lot of work to do. And at times, I think that ambition to be in the top four led me to treat people in a less than godly way. You know, you have to let people go. You have to ask people to work elsewhere. You have to get rid of some people, and that is a struggle. But I think at some times, it was less of a struggle for me than it should have been. I think one of the crosses that we bear as Christians is that we want to achieve good goals, goals of excellence in our academic work, but Jesus still says, but you never ride roughshod over people, and especially the little people. Now that creates a tension. Because to get things done, you just get rid of people and you move on. And I had some envy at times for some of my colleagues, because I saw the way they could cut through the emotional angst, the sense of having to think of this is a human being I'm talking about. And I think I'm reconciled to the fact that there is a cross to bear here. There is a tension. That God both calls us to the beauty, the glory of excellence, but also always to struggle to look after the little people as well. Now, of course, you have to make tough decisions. It's still a fallen world. You have to, in the end, make compromises in order to achieve your goals. But I think it almost always must be done at the cost of some pain inside about how we're treating people. So, I'm just going to come on actually to talk a bit more about how to think about our achievements in relation to our sense of worth, and how we can work a bit harder to mitigate this desire for social recognition. And I know that some of you will feel this stronger than others. I remember years ago talking about status anxiety, and we are hierarchical creatures who tend to look for the pecking order and to find out who has power and who doesn't, and to work to where we want to fit in that hierarchy. But I remember a woman coming up to me afterwards saying, Glyn, I mean, this is many years ago, but Glyn, that's a very male view of the world, this hierarchy. For me, it isn't about standing out. What I'm driven by is a need to fit in, to be included, to be recognized as a woman for what I am. Now, so I just want to say that there are different nuances here about how this desire for recognition manifests itself and is driven. But I do think the Christian story says to us, you will get a high from so other people's recognition at times, whether it's to stand out or whether it's to fit in. You will get some temporary relief. But achievement can never satisfy this deeper need we have to be loved for what we are and as we are. And I spend a lot of time in mentoring still, some academics, but mostly ministers, clergy, who are driven by a desire to achieve. It's extraordinary. And who grow disheartened because, of course, what the world does is it says, okay, you've achieved this. Now, what are you going to do to stay up there? It's a treadmill. It always moves on. It never stops. And therefore, it's deeply harmful, I think. And I'm seeing somebody at the moment just retired. Well, who is he now? He's stopped working. So what is his identity? And that's quite a big journey. And he's a Christian, but he's never really addressed this question of where his inner sense of self is really grounded. And for much of his life, I think it was grounded in the wrong place. I'll tell you what I'd like to do is just finish by addressing this question a bit more specifically then and more practically, which is how we think about the relationship between our achievements and our worth as those who bear the image of God. Because I suggest to you that Christians have a problem with thinking about our achievements. I talk to people about this all the time. Now, in the Bible, there's a clear injunction, command from Jesus not to use indicators of achievement to heighten our social importance and sense of hierarchical status and privilege. Okay, and that's very clear. We could talk about many of Jesus' parables in which he challenges us, that he challenges this desire to stand out, to rise up in the importance we are given from our social setting. And Jesus, really challenged this very strongly. And I think as Christians, we feel this, and we're also aware of the call to humility. But I think our difficulty is that we interpret this as of making ourselves be less important and standing out less, that call to the self, we interpret this as requiring us to make our achievements appear less or of less value or importance than they are. Do you see what's happening? In order to make ourselves appear less important, to hear what Jesus says about not like a peacock standing out and drawing attention or wanting to make ourselves less important and more humble, we make our achievements appear less important. And one of the common phrases in English British pietism still is you if someone seeks to praise you, that was really very good, thank you. We say it wasn't me, it was the Lord, you see. And that's a very problematic thing to say if you think about it. Or I said to a minister not long ago, I said, that was a really helpful word that you gave us. Thank you. And he looked embarrassed and he says, well, all praise to God, or all thanks to him. You see, it's nothing to do with me. All praise to God. I'm somehow not here. This thing that was accomplished, actually, I wasn't here. That's what's implied. And there's a little bit of a joke I sometimes tell about the man who goes up, someone's playing the organ in the service, and you go up to them afterwards. They're a very good organist, and you say, thank you so much for that gift that you shared with us this morning, and the way that you, with your music, brought a sense of beauty to worship and really lifted our hearts to God. And the person replies and says to you, well, it wasn't me, it was the Lord, you see. And so I say to them, actually, it wasn't that good. You know, if the Lord played the Lord played the organ, I think it'd be even better. It wasn't that good. And anyway, who played the wrong note? I heard the wrong note, you see. Who played the wrong note? And he said, well, I played the wrong note, you see. Now, the question is, what kind of a practical theology of achievement leads people to give the Lord all the credit for the right notes, but ourselves all the blame for the wrong notes? That is a very deficient picture of human flourishing, of the image of God responding to its mandate to be as God is in the world and to do his work and to carry out our calling. And so what do we do about this? How do we actually think about our achievements whilst hearing what Jesus says about not using our achievements to gain social status? Well, what I want to suggest is something very simple. Evaluate your actions, your achievements, and not yourself. Okay? The problem in secular culture is that it is so intoxicated by the desire for recognition, we link our achievements with our sense of worth, and therefore we put them out on the table and we say, look, recognize me because I've achieved these things. And it is an intoxicating feeling. This is a way of earning worth, but it is the boom or bust ego, because our sense of worth, if we base them on our achievements, is constantly on the line. It's always at risk. So we always have to keep running faster. And what I want to suggest is that the secret is to evaluate your achievements, but do not link that with your sense of self-importance or your worth as a human being. One of the new therapies, the humanistic therapies that rose up in the 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s, was something called rational emotive therapy. And it was invented by somebody called Harold Ellis. And it was one of the forerunners of cognitive therapy. And his great burden was to help us see that very often the way we feel is because of the way we think. And he said, we think in really crooked, irrational ways. We need to get our thinking clearer. And one of his messages about this whole area of self-worth is he said, rate your achievements, score your achievements